And, you know, they did Lawrence for 50 because she's a dependent. So, whatever. All right, moving on. We're going to start in the beginning, Genesis chapter 1. What do we know about Genesis? Anybody anywhere? When you hear Genesis, what do you think of?
Baseball. The book of beginning. Baseball,
yeah, in the beginning. It was really good. Yeah.
It just came up.
Sorry. Cool. In your hippie Bible. Way to go. What do you think of? I mean, really.
Phil Collins.
I like it. I like it. Yeah.
7 days.
Yeah.
Let there be light.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's quite expansive. A whole lot happens in Genesis. I mean, you know, and it explains a whole lot of where we are right now. And you have to make a decision at some point in your life how you're going to view Genesis. You're going to have to come to terms, and it may change. We have gotten into, well, we, I mean, Christendom in the United States has gotten into a roving battle with science over Genesis, and it just seems to go back and forth, and we invest a whole lot of time, energy, and money into this battle, a battle that I don't think should even be fought, but you know, and it seems to challenge some people's faith. But what I want to say is, I want to begin with this: the whole purpose of this book is to tell us who God is and who we are to Him. It really wasn't meant for anything else. That's my opinion. This isn't a science book. If God was to write a science book, nobody would figure it out, how he did these things. It would just be gibberish to us. And just much as if we wrote one now, what the people thousands of years ago would look at it and go, what? So let's start with some basics. The Jewish Bible is called the Tanakh. It's our Old Testament, but it's in a different order. It's the same books. It's in three spots. It's in the Torah, the Nevi'im, and the Ketuvim. The Torah is the law. The Nevi'im is the prophets, and the Ketuvim is the writing. So what they, you know how we do it? We have history, we have poetry, we have prophecy. That's how we break it up. Well, this is how they break it up. And they broke it up long before we did. And the hub of all of it is the Torah, the law, the first five books of the Bible, with creation and Exodus are the two big events, theologically, and everything revolves around those two things. Now, the Torah, what we would call the Pentateuch, is the first five books of the Bible. It literally means five scrolls. And there's three types of literature in those five books. Pure narrative, ancient poetry. And sometimes we get into trouble when we read poetry as narrative, and we don't realize it's poetry, that it's being said a certain way, realizing that the people reading it know I'm saying poetry, but if you don't know it's poetry, you start thinking it's narrative, and you could make some assumptions that shouldn't be there. And then there's pure law. And now Scripture tells us that Moses wrote it in three ways. First, the testimony of the Pentateuch itself. From Exodus 17, 13 through 14. So Joshua overwhelmed Amalek and his people on the edge of the sword. Then the Lord said to Moses, write this in a book as a memorial and recite it to Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven and earth. And then in 24:4 it says, Moses wrote down all the words of the Lord. And then he arose, he's using himself in the third person. He arose early in the morning and built an altar at the foot of the mountain with 12 pillars for the 12 tribes of Israel. Exodus 34, on Mount Sinai, the Lord said to Moses, write down these words, for in accordance with the words I have made a covenant with you in Israel. Deuteronomy 31:9, Moses' last counsel. So Moses wrote this law and gave it to the priests, the sons of Levi, who carried the Ark of the Covenant, and to all the elders of Israel. Deuteronomy 31:23 through 26, when Joshua takes over the law and puts it in the ark. And he commissioned Joshua, the son of Nun, and said, be strong and courageous, for you shall bring the sons of Israel into the land which I swore to them, and I will be with you. It came about when Moses finished writing the words of this law in a book, well, it's the law, until they were complete, that Moses commanded the Levites who carried the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, saying, take this book of the law and place it inside the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord your God, that it may remain there as a witness against you. Joshua 8:34-35. Afterward, he read all the words of the law and blessings and curses. This is Joshua after the battle of Ai. Joshua does this. According to all that was written in the book of the law, there was not a word of all that Moses had commanded which Joshua did not read. So what this is saying is, it's saying clearly that Joshua, after they're in the promised land, read Moses' words out of a book. And this is where we get this. Be all for all the assembly. Then in Joshua himself, Joshua 1:7-8, only be strong and very courageous. Be careful to do according to all the law which is Moses, my servant, commanded you. Do not turn from the right or left, so that you may. This book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate on it day and night. So here we have Joshua saying, he's holding up a book saying, this book that Moses wrote. And all the people are going, yep, he wrote it. It's not until later that we go, no, he probably didn't write it. Joshua 8:34-35. And afterwards he read all the words of the law and the blessings and the curses according to all that is written in the book of the law. And there was not a word of all that Moses commanded which Joshua did not read. Okay. Then in the New Testament, John 5:45-47. Do not think that I will accuse you before the Father. The one who accuses you is Moses, because they kept saying Moses is our father. So he says, well, then you have a problem with your father. He says, in whom you have set your hope. For if you believe Moses, you would believe me, for he wrote about me. So Jesus himself is saying, Moses wrote this stuff. But if you not believe his writings, how will you believe my words? Acts 15:21. For Moses from ancient generations has in every city those who preach him, since he is read in the synagogues every Sabbath. Romans 10:5, for Moses writes that a man who practices righteousness, which is based on the law, shall live by my righteousness. So Luke wrote it, Jesus said it, and Paul wrote it to the Romans. So, in our theology, Moses wrote it, the first five. This isn't saying that they have his copy, you know, that Moses wrote it down and they still carry the letter neatly tucked away in, you know, inside the suit pocket. You know, we don't have any original of anything. Even the New Testament, it just gets copied. The Jews were meticulous copiers, especially as it got on. You know, what was written, I mean, if there was an error on the page where ink slipped off, and they would copy the error and it would just be checked again and again. It was an art. It was done to the point of being almost religious. And, you know, it was, you were known for your ability to copy word for word, and they did. And now, that brings us to Genesis and why all this stuff matters. Because there, if you start to study this, they're going to hear people saying, well, Moses couldn't have written it. And what they will tell you is, well, the first five books were written by, you know, these different groups at different times. And I don't have an issue with where they copied what they had and they made their... It's much like... My New American Standard Version came out, you know, in an update in 98. I never claimed that book was written 2,000 years ago when Jesus walked the earth. I don't even understand the argument. You know, King James Version, what was it, 1611 or something like that when it came out? That doesn't make either one of them wrong. I don't get it. And I don't even understand why this becomes an argument. But I just want you to know it's there. And it's a strange... bit of an argument. It's that inbreeding of academia. There are so many people who are in academia that are really good at it and are really trying, but it becomes so self-absorbed on an issue that doesn't mean anything to anybody. And it just gets a life of its own. And then these are the people who are teaching the people who are going to be in the pulpits. And it just gets to be an issue. And that what they taught, and they will focus on the two creation accounts. There's one in chapter 1 and one in chapter 2. And they've come up with this theory that, well, it's starting to get challenged now, but it ruled the roost for about 100 years or so. It's called documentary hypothesis, which says there were four authors of the the Pentateuch, J, E, P, and D. Those one is, you know, is some scholars subdivide them even further. J stands for Jehovah, since the name of God was prominent in certain sections. E signifies Elohim, another defined name certifying certain portions. P reports to be priestly code, and D identifies as the Deuteronomic writers. Now, because of the way something sounds, they said, oh, these people must have written it. Chapter 1, in one chapter, one name's used for God, and then in the other chapter, the other name's used. So they said, well, that must have been different writers. And they're not even talking originally. They're just saying what we have now, which is so bizarre. I've written stuff that I've written, and in one paragraph I call him God, the next I call him Lord. And man, they've made careers out of this. And don't get absorbed in this stuff. I'm just going to give you a brief overview, so if you ever run into it, and if you study this at all, you're going to run into it. I just want you to be somewhat aware, is all I'm talking about, that it's out there. And it doesn't matter to me at all if somebody, if this guy wrote chapter one after he read what Moses wrote and wrote it down this way and used that word. It doesn't matter to me at all. Do I think it's what happened? Not really, but whatever. In this theory, known as documentary, became popular in the 19th century. He claimed that he had isolated these sources because of, and he actually picks the time, like the priestly code, the priests were the last ones to put it all together. And that was in the time of Ezra. And Ezra says there they did a lot of this stuff. And that so the Pentateuch as we have it now, as the Jews had it, is now it was established according to them, put together and in its final form by Ezra. Okay, I don't have an issue. If that's what happened, okay. It doesn't really mean anything to me, but for some reason it seems to be really important to them. In the case of the two creations, Genesis 1 is said to be a P document, dated from the Babylonians or the post-Babylonian captivity period, while Genesis 2 is supposed to be a J narrative from the 9th century BC. So this one was written then, that one was written there. The argument sort of supported this radical viewpoint is twofold. It is claimed that the two creation stories show evidence of different styles of writing. That's what they're basing this all on. It is argued that the accounts conflict and that they are reflective divergent concepts of a deity and a mismatch order of creation. Now, consider Genesis 28:13. The Lord speaks to Jacob and says, I am Jehovah, Yahweh, and God, Elohim of Abraham, and God, Elohim of Isaac. Would one argue for the multiple authorship of this single sentence based on the use of two Hebrew names for creator? And that is really what they're doing. I mean, it seems idiotic to say that, but they built careers around this and wrote books, and everybody said, yes. One scholar poignantly observed, it is argued in Genesis 1 represents animals as existing before man, 24 through 26, yet in Genesis 2 has Adam created before the animals are formed in 19. The text of Genesis 2:19 merely suggests that the animals were formed before bringing man, being brought to man. It says nothing about the relative origins of man and the beast in the terms of chronology. Now, as a response, chapter 1's broad outline and chapter 2 is a focus on man. Once again, and it's why I brought up that thing, you have to see the different kinds of writing. Some of this is poetry, some of it is meant to be said in a way that expresses emotion. And I guess that's the best way for me to state what poetry is, to entice emotion with words and truth. I found this. It was written by a guy named Kenneth Kitchen. And it said it better than I could. It struck me, and it was maybe the best way I've heard it said. It's often claimed that Genesis 1 and 2 contain two different creation narratives. In point of fact, however, they are strictly complementary nature of the two accounts is plain enough. Genesis 1 mentions the creation of man as the last of a series, without any details. Whereas in Genesis 2, man is the center of interest, and more specific details are given about him in this setting. So what he's saying is, the one was a general account. Chapter 2 is focused in on man. You know, God's his reason for doing all this, us. There is no incompatible duplication here at all. Failure to recognize the complementary nature of subject distinction between the skeleton outline of all creation on one hand and the concentration in detail on man and his immediate environment on the other borders on obscurism. He's basically making fun of them. In Matthew 19:4-5, Jesus combines quotations from Genesis 1 and Genesis 2. He declares, "He who made them from the beginning made them male and female," 1:26, and said, "For this cause, man shall leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh," 2:24. If the liberal viewpoint is true, how very strange that Christ should have given not the slightest hint that the two accounts involve multiple authorships and contradictory material, which is a very good catch. What he's saying is, if one is valid and the other is not, Jesus Christ, making his point, use them both in one sentence. Devout students of the Bible should not be disturbed by the fanciful, ever-changing theories of liberal critics. And if you just listen to them, they sound so sure, they state it so much as fact, it can challenge your faith a little bit. It is wise to remember that the Word of God was not written for the benefit of scholars, but for the common person. The Scripture assumes that the average person is able to understand the message and how to know that the source is divine. And that is what matters. What does he want us to know, and who is he? Those are the two things. Because you can get into these first couple chapters, actually the first half of the entire book, and get really wrapped up in it. Realize that this is about, it's not about how he did it, it's about who did it and why. Everything that is written here is about those two questions. And what I put is, they have no spiritual interest in the book. The book is spiritual in origin and purpose, so having spiritual interest in it is key to it. It's like studying a chemical makeup of all the parts of a pencil to understand it without ever realizing that it was made to write with. Liberal scholars continually view Scripture as a document to be studied as human literature, a reference for the understanding of man, when it is in reality means to understand God, whom we've been separated from by our nature, and we're going to get to see why. I mean, he tells us everything you need to know is in the first couple chapters of why we're here, why it's this way, and what's going to happen. At the inception, they have no conception of divine authorship of person or purpose. I have found their theories here far-reaching with the feel of partisan politics, where it is more important to win the argument than it is to be right. Like all of us, they find what they're looking for. The goal is to look for truth. That's what it should be. I have heard what they've had to say with an open mind, and I don't care how God brought apart any part of this book into existence, one author, two authors, or 20. I have no dog in this fight. But after review, I find the liberal arguments on authorship and contradiction to be weak, weak supposition built upon weak supposition. I find the ultra-conservative position of total and absolute literal acceptance a distraction and lacking faith. So both sides of the argument I find very hard to accept. These are the people that have to put their hands into the wound, like Thomas, to prove that they're there. I don't care if Moses wrote this all at once exactly as we have it, or four others composed it at different times much later from Moses' writings. It doesn't matter to me. It says what God's wanted to say, the way he wants it said. It does what he wants it to do, help me understand him, and through that understand myself as he is my creator. Hence, he knows why I'm here. He put me here. He knows why I'm here. I want to know. This is God's connection to us. It says what we need to know in a way that can be understood by everyone throughout the ages. This has ministered to people, no matter how smart or how, I'll use the word ignorant as far as not uneducated, it has said what needed to be said in a way that people could understand it. And bottom line is, God is either a product of our imagination, fear, or we are a product of his imagination, love. It is one or the other. The Bible is either our creation to understand ourselves, or it is God's so we can understand him. If you do not believe a God, the answer is simple. If you do believe there is, it's just as simple. He is God. He can take care of a book. He surely can. It amazes me that people who believe that God created the heavens and the earth can't take care of a book. He's God. The Bible is inerrant in its designed purpose. To argue about things other than its purpose is a waste of time. It's like finding a gold bar at your door, then arguing over its shape and color instead of thinking about who sent it, why, and what it's worth. You don't gain anything. Now, let's get to specifics. When it comes to creation, as a Christian, you have what they've condensed down to five possibilities of what you believe it is. One, it's literal. 24-hour days, seven of them. And in those seven 24-hour days, it all happened in sequential order. The next is the day age, where it's seven unequal time spans in sequential order. In other words, we don't know how long they were. The eras, you know, the Paleolithic or whatever they were, Jurassic, you know, and it that one came right after the other because it says there's this time period, that period. Calling it a time period. They're intermittent days, seven unequal time spans in overlapping order. In other words, the first one believes that it went to here, it stops, and a new one began. Well, the new one came while the other one was... this one, if you're a big fan of evolution, is palatable for you because it's basically saying the one blended into the other and it advanced onward. Framework, non-chronological focus, literary structure emphasis. In other words, it's an account given so you can understand what happened. It's not claiming to be literal. It's claiming to be literature, which is there to give you an understanding of what happened and why. It amazes me that we as Christians readily and easily embrace parables in the New Testament. We grab them and hold them and say, that's a parable. And boy, we can earn a whole lot from that. And we use them and we preach them. But when it comes to the Old Testament, we can't do it. I'm not saying that's what it is. This is your call. But I'm saying it amazes me that, because it takes faith to do that. I'm just leaving it there. The revelatory day. God revealed the process in 6 days, seven equal time spans in sequential order. What this is saying is Moses, who wrote it, God revealed one portion of it through a vision or a dream or whatever you want to call it, seven different times. And when God revealed the first thing he did, Moses wrote it down. Next vision, he wrote it down the next day. In other words, it's not saying that God did it, though. That's how Moses got it. It's not how God did it. It's how Moses received it. That's pretty much in Christendom, the people who have sat down and really, really thought about this. These are pretty much the five things that most people will fall under. Even most of us sitting here, if you don't even realize it, probably one of these five is what you believe. I will never tell anyone what to believe on either one of them. It's just, as long as you're reading the book and you're looking for what God is trying to tell you, that's what matters. So here we are. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. He didn't reorganize stuff that he found, stuff that came from somewhere else other than him. He made it of his being. How he did this is immaterial to me. I know what I need to know. God is completely responsible for all that was created. We're always left with that beautiful little thing, you know, well, there was a gas cloud that exploded and all this stuff. You're always left, where'd the gas cloud come from? You know, you're always left with that. And wherever you can't get to a point where it didn't come from, that's where God is. Honestly, you just keep... tearing down and down and down and down, and wherever it stops, that's where God is. It's tough for us. We don't have a concept of eternity always being. Even before any of this, he was there, and that's the important part. Also, the fact that he chose to do this. So what you're left with is there was nothing and then but God, and then there was all of this. So all of this could only come from one place. God. So everything that is, you have to conclude, if that's what you believe, is part of God. There's a danger in that because people conclude that and then they start thinking that everything is God. In other words, you start worshiping the creation. You start worshiping the sun, the moon, the stars. What's kind of interesting is because at this point in time where science is, I mean, what we will call cutting edge science is on this stuff, is why they built that giant collider in France and, you know, where they spin stuff around at the speed of light and what they're looking for, and it's amazing that they call it that, the God particle. That thing that can't be broken down any further. That thing that everything is built on. And I have no problem believing that everything that is connected to God. it is all an extension of him. And if you go into stuff that what Einstein called spooky action at a distance, this thing where we spoke a little bit about this last week, and I may have said it before, but in particles, there's two polarities, positive and negative. And if you were to exchange one, the other will change instantaneously. Make one positive and you turn it back to negative, then the other one will change. What they have found out is that no, if you split them and put them in two different spots, no matter how far away they are, when you change one, the other will change. 100 million light years away, it will change instantly. So there are only two things you can conclude. Something is traveling way faster than the speed of light, which is impossible in our science. Or everything is connected. Well, that fits very well into my theology, because in my theology, this is all God's stuff. But the important part of this, if you're going to accept that, is God. Everything that is God, but God is more than everything that is. This chair, this table, if you wanted to go to the spot far enough where Jesus says, if you don't say these things, these stones will. He wasn't being poetic. You know, when he came in on Palm Sunday, and he, you know, tell them to stop, and he said, if they stop, the stones themselves will cry out who I am. Creation knows who I am. Why? Because I created it. A beautiful, in chapter 8 of Romans, that beautiful thing, it says, creation itself longs and groans for the revealing of the sons of God. That's us. Where we're starting here, in the beginning, connected to Romans 8, creation, this thing he made, knows why it was made, and it is waiting for us to become what we were, for its purpose to be fulfilled, which is the revealing of the sons of God in everything that we should be. In other words, creation knows why it's here. It knows it's going to happen. And creation, which I don't see it as something foreign than God, God himself, he knows. It is, those parts of him are just waiting to, for it to be expressed. So when we start this in the beginning, I'm going a long way to make a point. But in this beginning, God has a design in mind and a purpose in mind that has nothing to do with climate, that has nothing to do with exploration. He wants something, and he's fixing it so he gets it. What does he want? Sons of God, so that we could be joint heirs with Christ. And Romans 8 concludes it beautifully by saying, creation itself longs for this moment. It depends which translation you read. Groans in anticipation for it coming. It's waiting for the reason for in the beginning to occur. And we live our lives ignorant of it. We go about our business. We think things are important. Nothing is important other than that. Nothing is important other than God's purpose. We explore the universe, and as well we should. And you know, all truth is God's truth. I applaud anybody who looks for truth. But to do all of it without grasping this, that in the beginning, as we're talking about this creation, this purpose is fulfilled through Jesus Christ. They knew what they were doing. When I say they, I mean God himself. This was a plan. This was thought out. This wasn't just random, hey, want to make a planet? You know, I mean, this. I'm bored. Let's make a planet. No, they knew what they wanted. They knew what they had to do to get it. And all, you know, there's a beautiful, was it Shakespeare that said all the world's a stage? I'm making that up. Was it Shakespeare? Yeah. It is. It's a stage where this gets acted out, where we, each generation comes in and faces what they need to face, go through what they need to, then when it's done, it's complete, they move on. Somebody else comes in, another group of souls comes in for God's purpose, for this revealing of the sons of God. This is all for you, is what I'm saying. So when he spoke this into existence, he did it thinking of you. And I mean just you. If you were the only one, he would have done it for you. That's how important you are. All of this. The stars that hang in the sky. The handiwork. It's what it calls it, handiwork. In other words, it's just to make it pretty. It's like, I have a purpose. I'm going to fulfill that purpose, but I'm going to do some artwork on the side. I'm going to make it worth my while. I'm going to enjoy this. That's how big this is. Job 38, talking about created the heavens and the earth. So what he's saying is all of it. That's all-encompassing. It's not like the heavens were there and he's an alien who decided to grab a, make a planet or get a planet and inhabit it, you know, wherever you want to go with this. He's taking total control. He made them. He created them out of nothing. Heavens and earth. The universe. 100 billion galaxies, each with 100 billion stars. That's big. And it's getting bigger every day, as they say now. It's expanding. And from my understanding now is, you know, I always thought there was all this words, how could they do that, how could you do that. And what I understand now, with now they're talking parallel universes, one could exist right next to the other. I've heard it said that you could create one in your basement if you knew enough. You could create a universe in your basement and it would expand to epic proportions and you would never even know it on this one. And everything they say about me, I just think of God doing it. And I said, wow, it, you know, and everything they say, stuff leaking from one universe into another. Gravity. They say the reason gravity isn't right, there's not enough gravity. You know, they just can't, at this point, something's wrong with gravity. Because they got this, we are on this giant ball of dirt, and if I drop a pin, I could pick it up with a little magnet, a tiny little magnet, and that whole giant ball of dirt can't hold that down from the electromagnetic force is that much greater than gravity. So what they're saying now is that some woman came up with the idea that the gravity leaked out of our universe into another universe. And they're serious. I mean, they put the stuff on the blackboard with the X's and the O's and say, there. And I go, okay. And all these things I hear do nothing but, I'm serious, confirm who God is to me. You know, we talk about how could there be a heaven and a hell that's separated from this? Well, man, if gravity could leak in and out of here, you know, what's stopping souls? And I just, the more I know, the more I look at it, the more it confirms who God is, what he's doing, and how spectacular this all is. I mean, it's just, we're just, we think we know stuff. And then when you run into this, you just start to see how much we don't know. And here's what Job had to say. From 38, 6 or 7. On what were its bases sunk? Or who laid its cornerstones? Talking about the heavens and the earth. When the joy of the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy. John 1 through 3. In the beginning. Oh, by the words, the exact same words in the beginning. The beauty of John, which we just finished, was the Word. And the Word was with God. And the Word was God. And he was in the beginning with God. And all things came into being through him. And apart from him, nothing came into being that has come into being. Who's the Word? Jesus Christ. So if you connect the beginning of John, the beginning of Genesis together, you get a beautiful picture of the triune God working out his will for you. Psalms 33:6, by the word of the Lord the heavens were made, and by the breath of his mouth worth all the host. This is about the who and the why, not the how and the where and the when, because they are incidental to its purpose. They weren't written for those things. It is as simply called the beginning, when God decided to do it. Before anything else that we call creation, there was God. Everything that is from God, yet God is more than all creation. If all creation disappeared, God would still be there in his full presence. Creation existence is owed to him, not the other way around. If creation went away, God would still be there. If God went away, so would creation. Revelations 4:11. Worthy are you, O Lord our God, to receive glory and honor and power, for you created all things, and because of your will they exist and were created. Because of your will, because you chose to do it. Jeremiah 10:12. It is he who made the earth by his power, who established the world by his wisdom, and by his understanding he stretched out the heavens. Power, wisdom, and understanding. Wow. He thought it through. He said, what do I want? What do I got to do to get it? And he had the power to do it. Verse 2. The earth was formless and void. Darkness was over the surface of the deep. The Spirit of God was moving over the surface of the waters. I draw a picture of that in my mind that makes the hair stand up on my arm. I just see the Spirit of God flowing over what he's created, what he's already made, and just looking over it and making his calculations or whatever it is he does. And it just gives me a mental picture that inspires me. appears to be saying that the stuff that was formed of the earth was all there. The chef's table of ingredients before the dish is created. The Hebrew means wasteland, empty, the void, what we would call the primordial sea. Many similarities between this and other creation accounts, which is very interesting. To me, this is more proof than disproof. Almost every culture has especially from there, has a similar creation account. They call different names. They call, you know, and they will use that to say, well, it can't be right because the other ones have this. They all flowed from one. And we don't know which one started. I think this is it. And there was, before they were Jews, they were all one group of people. I mean, let's not forget this. You know, that Palestine area, that whole Mesopotamia, all the way over to the Mediterranean, it was one group of people. Abraham came from Iraq. You know what I mean? Abraham wasn't a guy that was born in Jerusalem, because Jerusalem didn't exist. These were all one common group of people that broke up into different groups. And you would think it would be strange if they did not have linking accounts that came from one place and then changed over time. So what a lot of liberals will say, well, then this is the one that changed. Well, for us, it's the other ones that changed. And they'll say, but we found earlier versions of that one. That doesn't mean they're not there. That's just what you found. The fact that you found a creation account that predates the earliest one you found of this creation account doesn't mean anything. It's just what the archaeology found. We don't know what's there. But we do know this. These words have been taken care of for a very long time by people dedicated to taking care of them. They are extremely strong. The base premise in all of it is the same. Each group took the foundation and made what they wanted of it. The line from Abraham to Moses to Israel maintains a chain of custody for the authenticity of God's message. And you need to understand this. I've made this point before, but when it talks about them living to old ages, it means something. Who was a contemporary of who? Who was still alive or had just died when Abraham was born? I mean, they're connected, man. I mean, these people are all connected. Noah connects back to Abraham. Abraham connects to Noah. I mean, Adam, not Abraham. There's a connection of almost unbroken chain of custody of knowledge that runs from the other. In this verse, God is focusing on the earth, looking it over. It is this object of his focus and of all creation. We are the center of the universe. It is there for us, which is a strange thing. And I don't mean the literal center. I wouldn't know. I guess if you could see the whole universe, I don't know where we are in it. But it's the focus of his purpose, and that's important. God is actively involved. You know, it says he created the heavens. Then it gives us specific details on what he does with the earth. In other words, they are the icing on the cake. The cake is earth. He is focusing on it. He's purposeful. And we'll see there's a beautiful little phrase, or two phrases that says, it was good, and it was very good. And think about that as I read this, because when he's saying it's good and it's very good, what he's saying to me is, this will do exactly what I want it to do. He's looking at something he designed for a purpose and going, yep, that'll work. That's how I view it. Then God said, let there be light, and there was light. God saw that the light was good, and God separated the light from the darkness. It was good. This is what I wanted. That's where our phrase comes in. It will do what it was designed to do. God assesses his work and will. He's happy with it. If you go to verse 14, after mankind is made, it goes from good to very good. He called the light day and darkness. He called night. And there was an evening and there was a morning, one day. You notice... what's his first measurement of time? The establishment of order. Terrestrial days occurred during the first creation day. Before this, the only measure of time was what had passed between what God said something and when it occurred. For us, you know, time is just ordered, has always been ordered by us by the sky. Night, day, the stars' movements, God made the expanse and separated the water which were below the expanse, which were above the expanse, and it was so. In other words, what he did is he put land in the middle. Psalms 148:4, praise him, highest heavens, and the waters are above the earth. So both. The water that... Now, imagine you're, 5,000 years ago and water's falling from the sky. God doesn't put down a formula for you to understand evaporation, condensation, hitting cold and water. He just says it comes from the sky. Point is, I did this. This isn't something you go argue with people about how the water gets in the sky that it magically falls down and keeps us alive. We've figured it out. He's gave us a brain to do that. And God called the expanse as heaven, and there was an evening, and there was a morning, and a second day. Then something interesting happens. God said, let the waters below and the heavens be gathered into one place, and let dry land appear. Now, we get into a little part where it gets really interesting. God made creation, and it said, God did, God said, God ordained. Then he steps back, and if you just want to look at what it says, and then he allowed it to happen. Let it happen. Now, what he's saying is, I made a system that would work, that would do it. Let it occur. The stuff I did on those days is enough to put it in motion to let these things happen. Allow it to take its course. God called the dry land earth, and gathering of the waters he called the seas. And God said that it was good once again. Then God said, let the earth sprout vegetation. Plants yielding seeds, fruit trees. And so basically you could view this way. Is what he's saying is, allow it to happen. Isn't this what we say happened? Is this not exactly, it came in and of what was there? Not that I need to do this. I'm just saying this is interesting. I'm surely, basically, this is saying everything we say, that this was there and up out of it sprang life. And that God basically created what he needed to create and then said, let it happen. He steps back and lets the process occur that he initiated. Is it bearing fruit with kind seeds, and so it was. The earth brought The earth brought forth vegetation, plants yielding seeds after their kind, the trees bearing fruit with seeds in them after their kind, and God saw that it was good. I see no conflict here with science whatsoever. This is exactly what science tells us, that the earth was here and it came up out of the chemical reactions, proteins, and yada, yada, yada. I'm making crap up now. But this is exactly what it's saying. What I put there produced. I made it. It produced it. That's what I made it to do. I do not know how this challenges people's faith. I don't get it. God's still saying, I did this. I orchestrated it. I designed it. There was evening and there was morning a third day. And God said, let there be light in the expanse of the heaven to separate night from day, and let them be signs for the seasons and for days and years. Stars became visible for the longer term of keeping time of the ages. We've gotten away from it, but boy, the stars were all they had to say when the seasons were coming, and they could read them like a book. What they could tell from them is lost to us.
So wait, was a day considered night then? Day, because it keep saying
right.
Night and day, right?
And so when you get to this thing and you start doing that, look at what he's saying he's doing. Don't wrap yourself up in the night and the day thing, because if you believe that it's an age, then when it says the next day, don't take this literally. Is what I'm saying as far as the next day, because if there's night and day, how can there be days before it? If this is the day that night and day is separated, if you go far enough into this, this is the day that he ordered it. This is the time. What is most important part of this is he ordained it this way, and it's being said in a way that everybody can grab it, that things are as they are because he made it that way. And that's the important part. If you start saying, well, how could it be that day and then this day? You're going to go nowhere and you're going to miss the point behind what this is. Once again, this was meant for people from as far back and to as far as this science and life will take us. This will still mean what it means. I did this. I did it purposefully. I set order. And that's what night and day more than anything is, setting order. And the stars in the sky, so that you can tell what? So concentrate on that part, the seasons. In other words, so when God says, in 500 years, I will, you know, free Israel, you'll know what that means. He's building a time frame for what he's going to do. When he says eons and ages, and then he says there will be a time, even in Revelations, the timer says 70 times 7, and all these time frames will be 7 years, will be. Without a time frame, without something to set order, then he can't tell us what's happening and a general idea of when it's going to happen. This is, honestly, never lose sight of why he's doing what he's doing.
I mean more like right now we consider a day morning first, then nighttime.
As far as, boy, who knows what has happened throughout the ages on what a day is called. I see what you're saying. No idea.
Here it keeps mentioning right. Night first, and then the day. Is like a day.
Well, when you consider that we consider a day starts at midnight, which is not binding to any of this.
I'm just thinking some of the Jewish holidays begin right. at sundown.
Down. Right. When it gets dark. Yeah. When night starts.
We're doing it wrong.
Yeah.
I'm going to go kill some people.
Yeah. I'm running on the presidential platform of...
Night starts at day.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. And it said, and let them be lights for the expanse of heaven and give light to earth. And don't lose track of the poetry of this too. This is meant to be a colorful account to captivate you, to pull you in, to give you visual reference. Visual reference of the Spirit of God going across the primordial sea and just working what he works. And it says, God made two great lights. And once again, don't put these in try to order, because how could there be night and day and then he made the great lights? No, it's not even trying to give you an order. It's just telling you he did it, is what it's saying. The greater light governs the day and the lesser light governs the night. He also made the stars. Now, remember, it's telling us after he made the heavens and the earth, then it's giving us a detail on how he did it. God placed them in the expanse of the heaven to give light to the earth and to govern the day and the night and to separate the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good. Then there was evening, there was morning, there was a fourth day. God said, let the waters, once again, let the waters teem with swarms of living creatures, and let the birds fly above the earth in the open expanse of heavens. And then it says, let it happen, and then it says, and God created. If you want to get into looking for purpose and meaning behind this, you could be saying is, yeah, he let it happen, but it happened the way he wanted. He got what he wanted out of it. It just wasn't random. He didn't create a means of it occurring and then walk away from it. He didn't pull the cord and let the engine run. You know, he created a means of doing it, but his hand was on it. He said, the great sea monsters and every living creature that moves, and with the water swarmed after their kind, and every winged bird after its kind, and God saw that it was good. God blessed them, saying, be fruitful and multiply. Fill the earth with the sea, and let the birds multiply in the earth. Which is interesting, because what he's saying is, I made a self-sustaining environment. So every time, if I want more birds, I got to make more birds. Well, what he's saying is, I designed this. This is self-fulfilling. It will fill itself in over and over again. There will always be birds. There will always be fish. Until man comes along and starts killing them off. But, you know, until we... just have so much fun shooting them passenger pigeons. We just got to do it. But it's neat, because what he's saying is, I designed a self-sustaining system that will take care of itself. You know, step back and see exactly what he's saying. Don't get lost in the specifics of, you know, this stuff. Then there was a fifth day, and God said, let the earth bring forth living creatures after their kind. So, up out of the sea, then the birds, than living creatures. You can play science with it if you want. You could say there's an order there. But the truth of the matter is, I did it. Now God said, let the earth bring forth living creatures after the kind. Once again, let the earth do it. It's not saying that what I designed is doing its job. It's what I created it to do, and it's doing it. And it did. And the cattle and creeping things and beasts of the earth after their kind. And so it was. Once again, the earth brings forth the stuff that God wanted. God made the beasts of the earth after their kind, and the cattle after their kind, and everything that creeps on the ground after its kind, and God saw that it was good. What he's saying is, I didn't make one kind, I didn't make this, and they will always be their kind. And I know that we separate things down into species, into categories, and what this is saying that basically is, I set order to it. There will be this type, and there will be that type, because it's what I wanted. I sent order to it. And for the most part, kinds are with a kind. There's not much you can do about it. You can't really change it around. There's nothing that we've been able to do yet, I know, to get in there and monkey with it and make something that's not part of a kind. It, you don't see a half person, half giraffe, or a half, you know, it's a kind, and it seems to be etched in stone. But even now I'm stretching too far out of the purpose of God saying, I did this. Then there's the cool part that all that builds up to. And this is, God said, everything else is made. Everything else is there. All the ingredients are in the batter. Now for the important part. Let us make man in our image, according to our likeness. And let them rule over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the sky, and over the cattle and all of the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. Isaiah 64:8 says, but now, O Lord, you are our Father, we are clay, you are our potter, and all of us are the work of your hand. Mankind is exactly what he was meant to be. And when he was created as the pinnacle of creation to rule over. And we deal here with the singular plurality, God collaborating, considering with himself, a joint effort by one being. And I have no attempt here to explain the Trinity to anybody, but this is a plural. God saying, let us are, which goes back to what I told you in the beginning of John, the Word was there. The Word was with, the Word was God. The Word was with God. Genesis 3:22, the Lord God said, behold, the man has become like one of us, knowing good and evil, and now he stretched out his hand and taken from the tree of life. Genesis 11:7, come now, let us go down, let us go down and confuse their language. John 10:3, I and the Father are one. 1 John 5:7, and there are for there are three that testify. In the very beginning, we get a glimpse of who God is. Just as man's made, he's given us our first glimpse of who he is personally. We get glimpses of his power. We get glimpses of his intelligence, of his order. I set order to things. So we've been separated from God. We know nothing about him, absolutely, except this book. And what we start with right now is that he's knowledgeable. He knows exactly what he's doing. He has purpose. He sets order. He sets plan. And he has a purpose for all this. And he is triune. He is something that we are not. And we can't grasp because we are not. I've heard it said, body, soul, and spirit. That just doesn't even, to me, is, boy, it's the best thing maybe people could come up with. But this was planned. Let us. They considered it. He considered it. They and he are the same thing. And it's amazing. And then we get to the point. Okay, I'm almost done. Something really, really big here. The image of God. God decided to make us like him. And so often we grab this and we think, well, he's got two arms, two legs, two eyes, and a beard. Not anything what we're talking about. Let's consider what the image of God made. First, we were made perfect. It was very good. We were sinless. It was not our nature born into us. It's the nature of our fall. Second, we're eternal. We were created eternal. When I say these things, please understand this is what sin has cost us. I mean, honestly. Third, we were given authority over all creation. The authority who had? The Creator. He gave it to us. See, he's making sons. He knows exactly what he's doing. The big one, free will. Everything he created up until this point does what he says to do. Let it produce. Let it happen. In other words, I set it in motion. I push the button. It's going to happen. There is no options. There are no choices. Earth will produce what I told it to produce. It will happen the way I told it. The stars will be in the sky because I spoke them to. Free will of man is the changer in all of this. It is the only thing in all of creation that is not holy God. Everything else is God. It is a physical part of him. It is part of his creation. The only thing in this entire universe that is not wholly and completely God is our free will. And look what it did. Finally, this is the neat one a lot of people miss. We were able and given the ability to create life. To do what he did. To do what our Father did. Now you think of those things and think of what I told you God's purpose is to create sons. He's teaching us. He's given us everything here. We can create life. We just talked about it today. Honestly, we can do, he gave us the ability to do what he did. And I will say again, I never really understood who God was, the God I am separate. And he gave us all these things knowing we were going to fall. I mean, this wasn't Jesus Christ. Let me say it clearly now. Jesus Christ was not a reaction to our sin. Jesus Christ was the plan from the beginning. The fall was inevitable. As soon as he said, I want them to have free will. As soon as he willed free will to us, it was going to happen. It was just going to happen. Jesus Christ coming, living and dying and rising from the dead again was part of this plan in the very beginning. And we will see this in chapter 3 that, you know, boy, there's so much packed into here, so much theology. And we argue with people over rocks and ages and times, but the truth of what's happening here is just unsustainable. 1 Corinthians 6:2-3, or do you not know that the saints will judge the world? If the world is judged by you, are you not competent to constitute the smallest law courts? Do you not know that we will judge the angels? How much more the matters of this life? Grasp who you are. And what you are going to be. Do you not know that you will judge the angels? Why will you do that? Because you've been here. You've been in this creation that was created to do something, to make you the sons of God. I cannot understand how people can not grasp the beauty of this and the grandeur of this and argue about little bitty details that have nothing to do with what he's talking about here. We'll end there, and I appreciate your patience.